You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
It's the Pittsburgh Oddcast.
Welcome, everybody, back to the Pittsburgh Oddcast. My name is Andrew Lindberg, and with me, as always, is the founder of Odd Pittsburgh, John Chalkowski.
Well, hello, everybody. Today, I wanted to bring you a few additional tales. More trilogy of tales, I guess you could say, because it's the truth. There's more stories like this than, biographies or other. Well, actually, no, that's not true. I guess, I could just do every episode about a person, every episode about things that have happened. And while we could talk a lot, even in depth about some of these stories, I kind of want to share, like we always do, just a few shorter tales so we can fit more in. And of course, the first thing I want to talk about is something that's most likely on everyone's mind, and that is a pandemic or an epidemic.
Well, we're in pandemic.
We are in pandemic mode.
Mode now.
Now, that's exactly what happened in Pittsburgh in 1918. So we're talking about the Spanish flu, and how it affected a city. And when you hear this story, now this is what I'm going to read you is straight from the newspapers. Just the month of October. That's important to mention here, because these numbers will hopefully not scare you, but we'll give you an idea about what a real epidemic looks like within a city, especially in a time period where medicine was not really in its infancy. However, I guess cleanliness definitely wasn't in its infancy. Most people did not have showers, at this time period, let alone readily available soap at every single public place, So you can see there is a difference, whereas you were almost it was almost against you back this time period than it is today. But I will begin with the very first death caused by the Spanish flu here in Pittsburgh. And that was on October 4th, 1918. Charles Patterson, a 29-year-old resident of Aspinwall, dies in St. Francis Hospital. This was the first known cause of deaths solely by the influenza epidemic that would soon encapsulate Pittsburgh. So that's October 4th. He was the first person to pass away. October 7th, 284 new cases of the flu were reported in the city. The next day, 453 cases reported.
It's like doubling.
The day after that, 784 cases reported. Within days, Pittsburgh was gripped with something only seen before in the medieval days of the Black Death. On October 15th, orders were given. So that's October 15th now. That was a week, not even a week. Orders were given to close up over 1,400 saloons, 165 movie theaters. We had a lot of movie theaters, huh? The canceling of all college football games, all sports, a ban on public funerals, and only church services and schools remained open at the discretion of the congregation and their directors. The lack of knowledge on how the flu was transmitted was debated daily in the newspapers, leaving both the public and the medical professionals with unknown ways to prevent it from continuing to spread. Doctors and nurses, within days of treating sick patients, would soon see themselves sick and themselves on the verge of death's door. So now, on that same day, October 15th, 39 people died. 813 new cases were reported. On the 16th, 69 people died. The following day, 75 more people died. By the 19th, the flu epidemic reached a new high, 945 new cases with 124 deaths in a single day in the city of Pittsburgh. By October 20th, so this is 15 days from the first person to pass away, by October 20th, one person was infected every 90 seconds, and one died every 15 minutes.
That's crazy.
Yeah. But when the death toll in Pittsburgh was finally tallied in March the following year, the flu had reached 28,112 people within the city, killing 5,316 Pittsburgh citizens.
How many again?
5,316. Most deaths, and here's the strange thing, most deaths were from people between the ages of 15 to 39, with 2,994 of those deaths people between the ages of in their 20s. So more people in their 20s were getting this than any older person or infant. But by the time that this would be done here in North America, it would kill more people than that were killed in World War I, World War II, the Korean, and Vietnam Wars combined.
And how long did this take, do we know?
By October is when you first saw, now it started a month prior, basically, when it started spreading everywhere. And it spread almost the same way that you see the newspapers talking about today. In fact, you look at the newspapers from like newspaper.com and read about, you know, what was going on in just New York City. There'll be things like 100 new cases reported today. You know, the next day it would be 200 known cases. They didn't even really know. They just knew that more people were getting sick. And they started debating in the papers, like blaming the subway, you know, for transmitting the disease all throughout the city. You know, someone was sick over here in Brooklyn, and they took the subway to wherever, and now everyone's sick. Worldwide, no one even knows the exact number, but worldwide, it was 50 to 100 million people were infected with this thing.
That's a pandemic right there.
Yeah.
Which is, an epidemic affects a number of people that are exposed, and when it becomes worldwide, it becomes a pandemic, which is basically as
yes.
serious as you can get with the disease.
It is super serious. And the difference between what was happening then versus what's happening now is that it is very similar. You have to think about in some terms. However, we can prevent mass casualties like that occurred in 1918 as long as you act now.
Well, I think that's what the public is trying to do, and what officials are trying to do is a lot of people will say, well, you know, I'm healthy, and if I get it, it's not going to be a big deal. But if you go to visit your grandmother in an old folks home and you don't know that you have it,
right,
you can infect a lot of people.
The whole old folks home.
So yeah. While it may seem like an overreaction, I think that if you're constantly cleaning and keeping yourself as healthy as possible, even without getting coronavirus, maybe you prevent yourself from getting the flu or a cold, those are less people that go to the hospital.
That's right.
And
that's right.
More beds for people that are actually sick.
Yeah.
And while the Spanish flu, I think in severity of mortality rates, is a lot more serious than this COVID-19, it still is, you know, I think we've learned from our past. You look what happened.
Well, you heard that, you know, I mean, every day.
Well,
they're doubling the numbers.
Just,
you know,
looking at Italy, which has basically quarantined the entire country. On February 28th or 29th, they only had 821 cases. And as of March 11th, they had over nearly 12,500 cases.
There you go.
In less than 11 days.
Yeah, what they're predicting is that eventually it's going to be like the common flu, you know, that basically it's everywhere, and that it will take its own course and kind of, you know, you will work up an immunity towards it. And
Well, the only issue is that there's no cure right now. There's no vaccine you can get for corona where you can get a flu vaccine.
Yeah, not yet, you know. Same thing happens, you know, when you're exposed to a rare disease like smallpox. There was plenty of epidemics and pandemics with smallpox. Same thing with cholera epidemics.
Mumps.
You know, yeah. And even here in Pittsburgh, I mean, of course, Pittsburgh, to tie it back to the history, and maybe it's something I don't think we even mentioned, but there is a case of this, a disease, being used as a weapon. And the first known instance, what you today would call biological warfare.
Yeah, germ warfare.
All right. Was here in Pittsburgh.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And that involved a thing called the Siege of Fort Pitt. So the Siege of Fort Pitt was kind of like a revenge, of some of the Native Americans who were previously kicked out of here with different battles, like the Battle of Fort Duquesne and the Battle on Grant's Hill, all these epic battle names. You know, I love them. You know, the Battle of the Wilderness. You know, all sound good. But the Siege of Fort Pitt, where basically they were going to come and destroy what was left of Pittsburgh, the Native Americans, for spite, of course, you know, and all... I don't see why they wouldn't after the way we've treated them. However, orders were given through the government, and there's documented evidence of this now with letters that have been published in our state archives demanding that the captain of Fort Pitt on purpose give smallpox-infected blankets to the Native Americans as a peace treaty or like a peace offering. And most historians would agree. If you just type in the word biological warfare in Google and look at the history, you'll see they're going to mention the Siege of Fort Pitt and this incident, because this incident might be single-handedly responsible for the death of millions of Native Americans. Millions. Because you could see, I mean, just with this flu epidemic that we had in 1918, 50 to 100 million people. You know, that's what it affected. The Black Death. The bubonic plague.
But a third of Europe.
That was about the same. 75 million to 100 million is the estimate for how many people were actually passed away from the Black Death. So put that in perspective. it's record keeping. There's so many people. There was nowhere to bury them. You couldn't have funerals. It was bad news. But we survived. We are here talking, right? Not all of Pittsburgh was destroyed. 5,000 people did pass away. However, you know, the population of the city was in the million by that time. So we did survive. But it took a while. It took from October is when it first started happening, about till March of the following year is when it finally kind of went away. So it was a prolonged, you know, 4-month, 5-month ordeal, but it eventually did just go away. Crazy, huh? So that kind of gives you a little perspective about how something like that can unite a city, but also kind of tear it apart, you know, from the inside out.
Well, what happened at Fort Pitt? Was it the smallpox blankets?
Smallpox affected blankets, yeah. Captain Daniel Euler, I think was his name, the captain who was in charge of actually, like, administering these blankets. They had smallpox was a common infection for or Europeans, I guess, and they even had a smallpox hospital, as weird as that sounds, down at downtown Pittsburgh, and there were blankets and things that were used in that hospital that they gave to the people who have never been exposed to some kind of disease, anything like this. So the same thing you could say for any one of these other diseases. These are things we've never been exposed to. These aren't like measles, you know, or something like that. These are, it's a brand new thing. That's why it's scary. Same thing was like with H1N1 or the swine flu, you know, or all these other things that have happened in the past, but nothing as fast or spreading. It is historic, you know, what's going on right now with all the closures and everything like that, because people, if you look at the papers and how they handled it back then, that's even here in Pittsburgh, they closed 1,400 movie theaters, right?
Yeah.
And all that stuff. So they started taking precautions. By doing that, they were able to prevent it from getting even worse. But it is strange that it really affected mainly people between the ages of 20 and 29. I always thought it was like all the old people.
Yeah.
You know, well, or little babies or something. Or
back then, if you were 20 or 29, you were kind of already an old person, right?
Right.
Middle age.
Yeah,
because
middle age, 23. So, not to keep on the disaster theme, but have you ever gone up the incline and kind of like look back down and look down that hill and be like, wow, it's like, you mean I'm only being held up here by just like this one cable, just this one cable that's holding us all up here. But what happens if it snaps? What happens? Well, that did happen. And I'm going to tell you a story that happened in 1909. It was about the St. Clair Incline, which was in Pittsburgh's south side, right by 18th Street, kind of. It was 3:30 in the morning on April 6, 1909, several hours before the first gray streaks of dawn would slip over the hills lining the Monongahela River. Pittsburgh had been built around the three rivers, and it only used its early inclines to transport its workers to and from their homes on the hills at their working places in the river valleys. The night shift of the D.O. Cunningham Glass Company at Jane and 22nd Streets on the south side just finished its turn. The workers scattered, many of them heading for the St. Clair Incline, which lifted them up the steep hillside to St. Clair Borough, where they lived. Many of the passengers and people, employees of the glass company, were 15, 16-year-old boys. Because this is prior, this is still 1909, yeah. But that's what you did. You know, you went out and worked, 15 years old. On most mornings, there would be more than 50 people, men and boys, on the incline. But on this particular day, they were delayed and missed the first incline trip. On schedule, the creaky old incline began its descent. Men and boys grasped their empty lunch pails and either dreamed of the night's sleep that lay ahead or simply stared blankly into the darkness of the night. As the car headed towards the depot at the top of the hill, it appeared to proceed normally, though several passengers later said that the car seemed to have been moving unusually fast. And then, with a sickening jolt, the incline hit the cement abutment at the top of the hill and rebounded away from the platform, careening back down the steep grade at a rapid and ever-increasing rate of speed. Screams and cries of help filled the air. Two boys, Arthur Miller, 17, and Albert Klingenberger, 16, jumped from the railway car into the darkness of the hillside. Both were later found dead from their injuries. Frank Brettel, 17, also jumped, but he made his decision earlier before the cars achieved its maximum speed. Although he received many cuts and bruises, he was not severely injured. One of the other passengers, Herman Weiderschift, was reported to be the hero of the day. Other riders said that when the car started down the incline out of control, he yelled to everyone lie down to cushion the force of the collision. When he was interviewed by the papers, he said, "I can't remember what I did, but I hope that they reported it is true, because it was the right thing to do. You know that when you are speeding to certain death with only a few seconds left to live, you can't remember what you did. I was in an accident on the same incline several years ago, but last night was about the most thrilling experience of my life. I'm getting my nerve back just a little bit today, but I'm not denying that it was all taken out of me last night." Later, it was found that neither the cable on the incline had broken, but both cables had been torn loose from their drums. This was crucial to understanding the accident, because if that had not happened, the lower car would have begun its counterbalancing upwards, and they would have served as a brake on the descent of the upper car. Instead, the upper car careened wildly down the incline plane. So how about that? And the story goes on, because there's more to that story and the response. And but the kind of story that nobody ever died on the incline, which read if you just search the newspapers in the 1970s or 80s or even more recently in the 2000s, you're going to see no stories about people falling or dying on the incline, but it did happen. Whether that was people kind of hitching a ride on the back of the incline and just falling off and tumbling into the hillside, which happened all the time.
Well, that's a very dangerous hill. Every couple of years you hear about somebody up on Mount Washington and they start going down the hill and then there's a drop-off and they're gone, and you find out, you know, somebody from Missouri was visiting.
And right, and, you know, gone, you know, over Grandview Avenue. But but on the actual cable car, because that's the nice thing about inclines, is that even though it looks like it's unsturdy or unsafe, it actually is completely safe as long as everything is going okay.
Well, I'm sure they have safety measures.
The safety measure is the other car. So how the inclines work is they're connected through that drum that you see like at the Duquesne Incline. And because they're counterbalanced, if one were to snap or go down, the other one would kind of weigh it out and it would just stop. Slow each other down. It wouldn't necessarily go careening down into the valley. Where this was different is that the cable came off the drum, and there was nothing for it to stop it. And but that was pretty bad. And I wanted to mention that because a lot of people don't believe that people ever were hurt, especially when you see these old videos or old photos, and you see that the only thing that was holding people in the cars at the Duquesne Incline or the Mon Incline was just like a rope. They used to allow horses on there and stuff like that, too. So it was like, you know, I don't know, horses didn't just, you know, loud sound make them freak out and then just jump over the hill. Who knows? I'm sure it happened. And, but, yeah, that surprised me because I was always a, always thought it was the safest thing in the world, even the Mont Incline. And sure enough, there, if you look hard enough, you'll find that people there, you know, passed away too. So, last story I'm going to leave you with. And this is all, that last story, the incline story, and this next one here I'm going to read you, are from this great book. It's out of print. It's called Only in Pittsburgh. And it's by S. Trevor Hadley. And it has things on here like the Great Pittsburgh Poetry Hoax. Interesting, right? has stories in here about John Brashear, Billy Sunday, which we'll probably talk about soon someday.
Who's Billy Sunday? Just give us a quick preview.
Billy Sunday was this radical preacher who played baseball for the Pittsburgh Pirates for, I think, 7 or 8 seasons. An incredible name. That was his real name, Billy Sunday.
Sounds kind of like it could be a Western outlaw, too, or yeah. A preacher.
Yeah, exactly. But that he was known as one of the most charismatic preachers to have ever come around, especially here in Pittsburgh, but not just preaching here in Pittsburgh. He became a national celebrity. I mean, this guy traveled the country giving these sermons, and people reported in the papers like they've never seen anything like it before, like this man could capture an audience in ways that people have yet to see. So, and there is a really good story about him in here and his involvement while he was here in Pittsburgh and how it kind of led to his eventual confirmation as a preacher. The stories about the Pittsburgh Canal are in here. Of course, the Forgotten Islands and many other amazing stories. But
you probably have to go on eBay to find a copy.
You will have to go on eBay to find a copy. You might be able to find one on Amazon if you look hard enough, but it's not been scanned, or it's from the 1980s again. 1980s seems like a great time for Pittsburgh history books. So many different ones were being written. In fact, this S. Trevor Hadley was an older man at the time, and he has since passed away, because I looked him up to see. I mean, he would be a cool guest, yeah. You know? So, but now we just have to go on his words. But he talked about and compiled little stories like this, almost like Odd Pittsburgh. But the one I wanted to kind of share with you for the end of this episode was, what did people think the future of Pittsburgh was going to look like or be like? So think about yourself in 1920s or 1870s, or pick any date. And based upon your experience of that day, let's take 1928, for example. So from 1928, the year before the stock market, how would you imagine Pittsburgh to be 100 years in the future?
Yeah. Well, we've talked about this before. I listen to a lot of old-time radio,
mm-hmm.
and one of my favorite subjects is sci-fi.
Nice.
And there's a show called X-1 and Dimension X, and they're, post-apocalyptic type stories for the most part. But they'll be, let's take you to the year 1987, and there's right. flying cars and yeah. blah, blah, blah. So
I love that. I love seeing
just the idea of what you thought was going to happen.
Right,
I mean,
right.
if you think about that today, it still is, 20 years from now, they'll be flying cars.
Right, right. I mean, like, just like the Terminator, what was it, August 6, 1996. I still remember that Judgment Day.
Yeah.
Terminator 2.
And right? Back to the Future 2 is already passed.
Yeah. How weird is that?
2015.
That's the weirdest one, really. Although they did get many things right, which is fantastic.
Yeah, the Cubs won the World Series. I think it was a year later.
They still yet to really invest in holographic technology or self-lacing shoes.
And Pepsi still looks the same.
Yes. And still not free. So, but anyways, how do people think Pittsburgh was going to look 50 years, 100 years in the future from 1928? Well, somebody wrote that answer down. And I'm going to read you some of this man's predictions. His name was A.L. Humphrey, and he was invited to give a series of lectures for the Pittsburgh Chamber of Commerce. And one of the lectures that he gave was called Pittsburgh 50 Years Hence. And Mr. Humphrey was the president of Westinghouse Air Brake Company and the American Brake Company. In addition, he was a member and board of the directors of several other well-known Pittsburgh corporations. At any rate, he took his crystal ball in hand and tried to predict what Pittsburgh would be like 50 years from 1928. It's fascinating to look at his predictions, to square them against the Pittsburgh that did occur in the 1980s. So we're talking about what this man thought it was going to be like in 1988. It's 1988 Pittsburgh. He first predicted that there would be one municipal government for all of Allegheny County. Mr. Humphrey considered this prediction to be a sure one. Legislation had been introduced in the state capital in Harrisburg to do just that. Pittsburgh and Allegheny County were to become one metropolitan city in the same manner that has happened to Philadelphia and Philadelphia County. He gloried at the fact that such a merger would eliminate waste and encourage efficient coordination of services in the 124 independent municipalities. Seems as certain as anything human can be, he said. He talked about the prestige that would come from a city of 1.5 million people, new trade, new industry, new cultural advantages. He pointed out how community improvements of countywide proportions could be accomplished. It was hard to fault his reasoning at the time, but his ability to prophesize was a little bit suspect. What would his reaction be today if he could return to his beloved city and see how that, almost 100 years later now, no progress in that direction has occurred? Today, we still face that same issue. How you have a county and a city government in the same building.
and that's still been, every couple of years that is brought up.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not, I don't think it's been taken seriously, but it has been considered. You know, it'll be asked every couple of years, the mayor or the county executive, why don't we just do what Philadelphia does?
Yeah.
And become
more people in your city means more resources from the government, the main government. So that does make a little bit of sense. His second prophecy was that Pittsburgh would become the center of the entire nation's water transportation facilities. He said that Pittsburgh was at the head of the world's greatest waterway system, and that it was inevitable that Pittsburgh would experience enormous expansion of trade and would become the nation's greatest center of water transportation. Unfortunately, that development never happened, of course. Dams in the Ohio River helped flood control, but the massive development of the nation's railroads and the rise of the great trucking industry pushed river transportation into history. The third prophecy was closely related to the second. Mr. Humphrey predicted that the Ohio River and the Lake Erie Canal would become a reality, making Pittsburgh a lake port. That's interesting.
Hmm.
The canal, of course, was never built. Pittsburgh did not become a great lake port, and the water tonnage continues to work its way through the St. Lawrence Seaway to the Atlantic Ocean instead. Mr. Humphrey anticipated that all of Pittsburgh railroads would be electrified and that the use of coal and steam locomotives would be truly eliminated within just a few years. Steam locomotives did finally become obsolete, but it took a long, long time for that to happen. The power which was utilized to drive them was not usually electricity, even in the 1980s. His fifth prophecy was that 50 years from 1928 would find Pittsburgh in the midst of the airplane era. He felt sure that every able-bodied man would be licensed to fly a plane, and that the principal means of communicating to and from one's employment would be from airplane. That would be great. Can you imagine? I'd be right there. I'm just looking for a spot to land, you know?
Yeah, all of us have John Travolta's runway backyard
right.
or whatever.
Yeah, keep my captain hat in the back seat. The difficulty of landing the planes would be solved by new planes, which could land in small areas and would prove to be amazingly economical to operate.
So like flying cars, kind of.
Exactly like flying cars. And you know, what's funny about that that concept is, you know, we've talked about that Gustav Whitehead and the first in flight here in Pittsburgh. The man who was behind part of this international research team that I got involved with, a man from originally from England, but then he lived in Australia, and then he was living in Germany when he contacted me, was hired by Boeing to literally invent a flying car. And according to him, and video that exists on the internet through Berlin and his type of small airplane, he did it. So
when was this?
This was actually about 10 years ago is when he first had this idea. Now, the problem was it's too expensive to kind of mass produce it at the moment. So his version would cost something like $250,000 to produce this tiny small airplane, which was exactly basically what this guy was describing in the book, which was very easy. Anybody could basically drive it like a car. And if you just knew how to drive, you could fly this airplane and you could land it pretty easily with just some basic training.
Well, if Tesla's not involved in it, it's probably not economically sound yet.
Right.
Still.
That's right. That's right. So the technology is kind of there. It's just that it's just not financially feasible, and we'd have to change our inner system, and PennDOT would block the airways anyways. You know,
I mean, if I was Mark Cuban, I definitely Be like,
yes.
Throw half a million or a million there.
Yeah, that's true. One last thing he says was that he flatly stated the city of Pittsburgh would have a population of over 2 million people by 1970. The 1980 census gives the Allegheny population of 1.4 million. Okay, so they was close. The figures are quite reasonable if the city had merged with Allegheny County, of course. Instead, we selfishly pursued our separate ways of identities and created innumerable confusions and overlappings of service, which continue to this day.
Oh, yeah.
Currently, the population of the city of Pittsburgh, 350,000 people. So a city that was built for a million, 2 million, at one time had 2 million people living in it, for real, has dwindled down to numbers that were equal to about 1910, 1920 era. Of Pittsburgh. So the best thing about that, which I'm kind of happy about in a weird way, like, yes, I love to promote Pittsburgh, and of course you want people to move here and enjoy it as well, but it's also nice to have all these resources and not really be that crowded, and to think that these gigantic institutions, these huge museums or schools, you know, were built here for all of us, for all these people. And now that those people don't live here and we're stuck with this kind of like 300,000 people, we can kind of really enjoy these. It's a really cool opportunity to enjoy these sources and these things that were left over by the Gilded Age that we can now experience as a small city. We're a small town. We might look big, but at least on paper, it's a small town.
Well, yeah, but you also have Allegheny County with over a million people.
Right.
And while people might not live in the city, you know, as far as Cranberry, which is not technically Allegheny County, you still consider that kind of Pittsburgh. So it's
right.
People are here.
Yeah.
They're just not.
They are. They've moved north or south or east or west outside of the city. And but it is interesting to think that just downtown and or, you know, the city part of Pittsburgh, that did have that high of a population at one time. And you can with that type of a high population, you have horrible things happening, like extreme wealth and inequality, slums all over the place, people, you know, not being able to you know, have some kind of safe living condition or even go to school because there's just so many people, so crowded, so difficult to maneuver, and the resources just were being taken up by everybody. Pittsburgh is a really interesting town to look at that type of a history, population history, and then how we reacted to immigration. You know, all of our ancestors were immigrants, all of them, right? Mine being Polish and Slovakian, and on my at least my dad's side, Italian on my mom's, and all of them came here. All of them were persecuted. All of them. It doesn't matter what nationality you were, just because you happen to be here. The people who were here 50 years before that, you know, think that they had dibs or whatever they called shotgun,
yeah.
And, you know, you can't work here or live here. And the same thing goes on today. But it's interesting to see how people reacted to the same type of problem. You have this influx, you know, all of a sudden the population of Pittsburgh is 500,000. Well, 10 years later, all of a sudden it's doubled. Right. And all those resources are being used up. All the jobs are now taken. So how did Pittsburghers react to that massive wave of immigration, like the 1880s to the 1920s? And that is an interesting story we probably will talk about. And I will leave you with the very last predictions. Okay. And this was the same 50 years from that date. Somebody in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette decided to write a little follow-up, yeah, which is what I'm reading here, but what it would be like in the year 2000.
Hmm.
The year 2000.
The year 2000.
Among the many prophecies, great and small, were the following. The major growth of a city will occur in Oakland. At least one new hotel and several new office towers will be built in the Golden Triangle. There will be a computer in every household. Fax machines will replace the telephone as the major communication tool. Public school teachers will become highly paid professionals with top salaries of $90,000 a year. This was in the year 2000, of course. You know, I don't know if they make that today. Kitchens and homes will be designed as entertainment centers. Most food will be shelf-stable and will require no refrigeration. Interesting. Debit cards will automatically deduct the cost of food products and supermarkets from your bank account. It's getting close to actually happening.
Yeah, and Amazon stores in other cities.
Your family car will be designed to become your breakfast nook of the 21st century. That one's a little weird. Especially with all the potholes we got around here. We will have a woman president in the year 2000.
Almost. Not in 2000.
Professional sports will have global conferences. Magnetic levitation will be the next high-tech industry.
It's
To be fair, they tried.
Around,
they tried.
It's pretty expensive.
It is expensive, and they did try here in Pittsburgh with that with the monorail.
Yeah, maglev.
Yeah, I mean, think about the coolest thing about that story with the monorail kind of being invented here and first set up here was that Walt Disney himself visited Pittsburgh to come see that monorail in action to see if it was something that he would want to use in Walt Disney World. Well, that was pretty cool. And the last, movie theaters will have roomier seating, automated concession stands, wider menus of real food, and satellite systems which will deliver movies straight from the studio to the theaters.
It's, I mean, today, not in 2000, but today it's gone digital.
Yeah.
And, the prophecies, seats are bigger.
That's true.
But you still have people cashing you out and everything.
So. Yeah, they do. They do. And prophecies are interesting. When I was a kid at my grade school, there was this book called The Omni Future Almanac. Right, it was published in 1982. You know, you can see the copyright date right there in the book. And in that book, they predicted every single year. They had the best futurists known to man. This is Omni Magazine. It was an offshoot of that magazine, which is like a science magazine. But they predicted yearly what they think might happen. And in 1996, they predicted 100% accuracy. Like that list I'm reading. There's a list in that. Everything on that list happened in 1996, the year they said it was going to happen.
Wow.
Now, they were way off on some things, like technology. They didn't expect technology to be so advanced. They thought, you know, of course, people will have video games or something by the 1990s, but maybe just handheld. They said handheld video games or on your watch or and things like that. And they talked about the future of fabrics and technology like with clothing and how people would kind of, the leisure suit of yesteryear would now become sweatpants. The fancy sweatpants society.
Well, I think people are trying to pull that off.
Yeah, including me. And but that is the truth. But that was predicted in this book. And they actually, but when it starts to get the years to 2000, they start skipping by 10 years. They tell you every 10 years what they expect to see happen based upon everything that's come before. So when you talk about Pittsburgh history or history, there's nobody better to ask about the future than a historian, because we've seen how these patterns of the past and these things that have already kind of occurred and how they handled it, or and you can see what they did wrong, you see what they did right, and you just try to make it better in the future. Yeah. When I give speeches, that's what I tell the kids. I go, understand that these people are Pittsburghers just like you and me, and that, you know, you can be one of these people. You can strive to do that, and if you do that, you can change the world, and for the better. And all you got to do is study the past. History doesn't maybe not always repeat itself, but it does rhyme, and so it's important to look for those rhythmic beats within history and how we can learn and progress. That includes talking about the flu. That includes talking about incline disasters, I guess, and, of course, predictions based upon at least what we could see or predict from then. So if you have another tale and a story that you want to share, and we have some guests lined up. We were supposed to have one today, a pretty cool one, and we will be having that because I talked to them, and somebody from the WWE, so World Wrestling Entertainment, and wrestling, Andy, has been around for at least since the 1850s here in Pittsburgh. So, I mean, think about that. Was there a macho man of the 1850s?
Yeah.
Tune in later to find out, and we will share some of these stories with you. But also, we'll be doing another episode on some female history-driven shows, probably in the month of March here, and among many, many other tales. So, I want to thank you for listening. And without further ado, Andy, that's it for Pit.
Wash your hands.